I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Susan Rice shows a career path where few women and even fewer women of color were making a mark. Today, the former National Security Advisor and former Ambassador to the United Nations shares moments of that life as told in her just-released memoir. Rice tells what working in the White House was like, what she went through in the aftermath of the Benghazi attack, and her thoughts on the Russian interference in U.S. elections. Then, it's hard to find stories about older people falling in love, but the current production at the New Theater does just that. The leads of The Last Romance will join us to talk about their careers in acting and their chemistry on stage. We'll get you up to date after the news. Ambassador Susan Rice has seen the best and worst of what Washington has to dish out, and she's lived to talk about it. In a new memoir, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For, the former National Security Advisor tells her story for the first time and what it's like to work just steps from the Oval Office. Under President Obama, she experienced towering highs with the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, ranking as just one of them. And she also found herself in a political crosshairs when she became the focal point of Republican frustration over the attacks on two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya, that led to the death of U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens. Stevens was the first U.S. ambassador killed in the line of duty since 1979. Ambassador Rice will be speaking in town Tuesday night. More on that in a few moments. Ambassador Rice, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Steve. Thank you.
You know, you come from strong people, Ambassador, who persevered. Tell us about your parents.
Well, my mother was born in Portland, Maine. She was the daughter of immigrants from Jamaica who came to Maine in 1912 with nothing. My grandfather was a janitor. My grandmother was a maid, and they had five children.
And they put them all through school, and they all did remarkable things.
That's right. My two doctors, one university president, a optometrist, and my mother, who was both a leader in the corporate world, sat on 11 corporate boards and was an executive herself. But most importantly, she devoted the bulk of her career to expanding educational access for low-income people so that they could attend college, and was known as the mother of the Pell Grant program, which has enabled 80 million Americans to access college. My dad came from segregated South Carolina. He was born around 1920. He served in World War II with the Tuskegee Airmen and went on to become a PhD in economics and serve as a governor of the Federal Reserve after a career in the Treasury Department, the World Bank, and the private sector. But his struggle was different than my mother's. My mother's experience was really the classic immigrant up from nothing, American dream sort of story.
Yes.
My father's was an American dream story, but of a different sort, overcoming Jim Crow and the brutality of segregation to rise to get an education and to succeed. And they had a very important impact on me, set the bar quite high, and taught me the value of education, of service, and of trying to achieve excellence.
Ambassador, they set the bar quite high because they knew they had to. Do
yes.
I have that right?
Well, they knew they had to in their own experience to rise, but they also understood that as African Americans, my brother and I, born in the mid-1960s, at a time when change was coming but hardly had been fully set in course, that we, as they often taught us, had to be twice as good as other kids in order to be considered almost equal.
So you call the book Tough Love. Why?
Because, Steve, that was the way my parents raised me. It's also the way I've tried to raise my kids with my husband, and it's the way I've led my teams in government. And frankly, it's also the way I've loved and served my country. Tough love to me means you love fiercely, but not uncritically. So if and when the person you love or somebody who loves you feels it's necessary to tell some home truths, as we like to say, or just straight honesty about how one is doing or not doing. That's how you love somebody. You love them by giving them the benefit of being candid, by being forthright, even when that information may be tough to swallow.
And that's the kind of relationship you had with President Obama.
Yes. But, my strong view of the role of any senior advisor to the president, but also in particular the national security advisor, when you're delivering very difficult information every day, bad news much more often than good news, is that you need to be able to tell the president of the United States what he and what one day she needs to hear, and tell it to them straight. And you need a president who's willing to hear bad news and not shoot the messenger. And fortunately, I had that relationship with President Obama. And, even on days when the news was discouraging and the options were bad, he understood that it was my job and that of our team to give it to him straight.
He gave you a hard time about lots of things, particularly sports. Tell us about that.
Well, President Obama is a very good athlete. In particular, he's a very good basketball player. I was a pretty solid athlete coming up myself. I played high school basketball.
You're a basketball player and a tennis player.
Fairly mediocre basketball player, considerably better tennis player. And I still play tennis to this day. I've hung up my high tops a long time ago. But President Obama used to tease me about his confidence that he could take me on the tennis court. And quite frankly, having seen him hit, there was no way that was the case. I knew enough not to get on the basketball court with him, but ultimately he had enough sense not to get on the tennis court with me.
But what's the takeaway, the lesson in leadership you take from President Obama, who was able to hear hard news, and yet he worked his relationship with you in such a way that clearly you feel great fealty towards him?
Yeah, well, President Obama's leadership style, as the American people could see, was much the same behind closed doors as it appeared in public. He was thoughtful. He was a voracious consumer of information. He was very, very smart. He was even-tempered and deliberate in his decision-making. And he really wanted to understand the views and the perspectives of the experts who served him. And so briefing him, readying him for decisions, watching him work through the toughest issues was really quite gratifying because he wanted to get it right. He took the time to understand the context, the history, the analysis, the intelligence, the risks and benefits of the choices before him. And then he made, informed and thoughtful decisions. It didn't mean we always got it right, but it meant that, we were trying to get it right, and he was making decisions with the national interest at heart.
Ambassador Susan Rice is my guest. She'll be speaking at 7 next Tuesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. This is a Rainy Day Books event. For more information, go to rainydaybooks.com. Well, there's a pretty sharp contrast you've been saying lately with the Obama White House compared to the Trump White House. You say the White House is obviously an extraordinarily intense place to work, but this is, to use your words, this current administration is beyond strange and even the Twilight Zone. How so?
Well, Steve, the national security decision-making process, which has served Democratic and Republican presidents well for decades and involves, the preparation very carefully from the various agencies of the government, the State Department, the Defense Department, the intelligence community, of options and analyses surrounding decisions on the most difficult issues. That decision-making process has completely broken down. The National Security Council principals, which I chaired as National Security Advisor, these are the secretaries of these agencies, rarely, if ever, meet on the most difficult issues. What should happen is they meet and make recommendations to the president. The president should sit down with them on tough issues as well. And below them, their deputies and their experts at the working level should be preparing inputs to their decision making and then ensuring effective implementation of decisions that are made. That process is broken down. And beyond that, we have a president who, as everybody now can see makes decisions quite impulsively on his own without regard to the advice and input of those around him. And that's how we have the disastrous situation that we have today in Syria, where the president made a unilateral off-the-cuff decision to greenlight the Turkish invasion into Syria, to cut our ties to the Kurds who had worked and sacrificed in the fight against ISIS on our behalf, and to leave an extraordinary opening for ISIS to reconstitute itself, and for Russia and Iran and Assad to reassert control over a large portion of Syrian territory.
How wrong was that decision in your view?
On a scale of 1 to 10, 12.
Because
of what I just said. Mm-hmm. Because it will enable ISIS to reconstitute itself. You know, we've seen in the Middle East the hard way, frankly, including in Iraq, that, you know, when we take our foot off the gas in terms of pressure against terrorists, they regroup. They form new cells. And so what we've already seen in Syria in the last 10 days are a number of serious terrorists who had been in prison escaping. We've also seen sleeper cells reemerge. And we've seen ISIS conduct attacks in that part of northern Syria where they had been largely dormant.
But Ambassador, you know, the president says, and he says it over and over again, that Americans no longer want to be fighting wars half a world away. They've had enough. What about that?
Well, a lot of Americans share that sentiment, but we need to be rational in distinguishing between these wars. It's one thing to be frustrated about a deployment in Afghanistan that has been our longest consistent war for now almost 20 years and has involved tens of thousands of U.S. forces, and we can talk about Afghanistan. But in Syria, the United States had under 2,000 U.S. servicemen and women at the height. Today, we have about a little over 1,000. They're not involved in combat on a day-to-day basis.
And this is a huge army, is your point.
Exactly. They're advising and assisting the Kurds and the Arabs who have done the fighting. And by the way, Steve, you know, the president says he wants to pull our personnel, our military personnel out of the Middle East. And he's focused on Syria. But what he doesn't highlight for the American people is that since May of this year, President Trump has deployed 14,000 additional U.S. troops to Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Gulf. Why? Because he pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal and imposed vicious sanctions on Iran, and Iran has reacted. And now the tensions in the Gulf have led to escalating tit-for-tat violence, and that has led the president to decide he needs to deploy 14,000. So you put 14,000 in, and you take about 1,000 out, and that, to me, is an ending endless military engagement in the Middle East.
Ambassador Susan Rice is my guest. Her new book, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Different topic here, Ukraine and the Biden controversy. Put a frame around that for us, if you would, Ambassador. How egregious do you think that situation is? What do you think happened here?
Well, Steve, we know what happened because we have the benefit of the president's own words in this partial or not so partial transcript. It's hard to know. Mm-hmm. And we have the testimony of advisors around the president that is now coming to light. And what it shows is that the president of the United States extorted from the newly elected president of Ukraine, the president of Ukraine's effort to provide false information or concocted information on Vice President Biden's son, in order for the president of the United States to use that concocted information against a perceived political opponent, Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And the president of the United States said, we're not going to give you up to $400 million in badly needed military assistance that the Ukrainians desperately required because they have Russian troops occupying their territory and shooting at Ukrainian soldiers every day. And he said, well, I won't allow you to come to the White House for a visit, which would have been an important political boost to a newly elected president of a partner country, unless you make up this dirt and give it to me. The extraordinary thing, Steve, about that phone call as a former national security advisor who sat through many such presidential phone calls,
right,
is that not one thing that the president raised or asked of the newly elected Ukrainian president was in service of United States national interests. He didn't talk about sanctions. He didn't talk about how we could support the new government. He didn't talk about our concern about Russian occupation of eastern Ukraine. There was nothing in there that bore any resemblance to U.S. policy objectives. It was all about the president's personal political interests.
Are these impeachable offenses, Susan?
Well, I am not a member of Congress, and I'm not a lawyer, but I think whenever the president of the United States puts his own personal political or financial interests above the national interests, that that's an abuse of power. And it certainly merits, in my judgment, an inquiry to explore what else has happened. And then when you combine that with the president's public request of China to interfere in our elections in a very similar way, and combine that with the, I would argue, inexplicable decision to withdraw our forces from Syria suddenly, which Democrats and Republicans alike view as a horrible blow to our national security. One has to ask, what is motivating the president to make these decisions, to act in this way? In the case of Ukraine and China, we know it's his personal political interest, maybe financial as well, but it's still to be determined, in my estimation, in the case of Syria.
You tell a fascinating story about Donald Trump before he became president late in this book. I believe this is your first and only meeting with Donald Trump. This was at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, which you describe as a pretentious mass gathering of the press, celebrities,
yes,
and administration officials. There was a break in the dinner at one point when you found yourself suddenly summoned from your chair by what you describe as a large and unexpected visitor. This was just weeks before Donald Trump launched his presidential run. He came up to you from behind. What happened there?
Well, you call it a meeting. I'm not sure that's what
I
term it.
That's too nice, probably. Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting there with my back to him. And it's, as you said, one of these breaks in the dinner. And which is, by the way, an annual root canal,
yes,
for a senior government official.
I can only imagine.
And the one thing, I won't go there. Anyway, so I'm sitting there and this large person comes up to me from behind and I just sense this presence behind me. And he kind of grabs me by the shoulders and almost lifts me out of my chair. And I turn around. First thing I do is try to find my husband, who's not in in proximity. And I turn around and I realize it's Donald Trump, whom I'd never met before. And he's a big guy, as you can see. And he grabs me and hugs me. And I hasten to say that it wasn't a creepy, gross hug, but it was a hug. And he held me for a period of seconds and he whispered into my ear, "You've been very unfairly treated over Benghazi, and you're doing a great job for our country." And I was so stunned because, one, you know, it's very bizarre to have somebody you don't know physically grab you and hold you. But knowing that it was Donald Trump and knowing that he'd spent, you know, years attacking President Obama and many of us in the administration, for him to say that to me was striking. And then, you know, pretend that it was an unpleasant encounter, except for the weirdness of the hug. And we then were asked by a journalist in the vicinity to take a picture. And so there's a picture, I'm afraid, of both of us smiling too broadly,
yes,
before the camera. So it was a really bizarre instance. But what it said to me, and this was some 6 or 7 weeks before he declared his presidential bid, that there's a great gap between what the president says and does in public and what he's prepared to say in private. And that was an early indication of that.
You mentioned Benghazi. I just got you for a couple more minutes here. You got dragged into this controversy. That's how a lot of Americans still remember you today, during the 2012 presidential campaign and even afterwards, at a point when you were a top candidate to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Reviews of those attacks from political opponents have since concluded that they were misguided. But it may have still, you know, it may have cost you a chance to become Secretary of State. You don't suggest in the book that you have much bitterness about that, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I certainly don't appreciate at all, still to this day, right, the attacks on my integrity, my honesty, my competence that came from some on the right, in particular some in Congress. But in terms of how it affected me, I write in the book that it was really a big blow to my 9-year-old daughter and to my ill and aging mother.
They both so really suffered here as a result, yes.
They did, and I wish we had time to talk
right,
about it. But
right.
The point is that it hurt my family, so that therefore also hurt me. But in terms of my professional prospects, I made the decision after some months to take my name out of consideration for Secretary of State because I didn't want a lengthy, bloody battle over my confirmation, even though I thought I could win confirmation. But I had the privilege to go on and serve as National Security Advisor, and I was sitting in a wonderful job working on behalf of the U.S. at the United Nations, representing our country to the world. And I wouldn't trade the privileges that I've had to serve this country for anything, and I certainly wouldn't complain about being responsible for coordinating our national security policy and advising the president as national security advisor. That was a great opportunity. So I'm not bitter in a professional sense in the least, but I did think it was time for me to tell my own story in my own words. And that's why one of the reasons why I wrote Tough Love. And I didn't want to be characterized or mischaracterized by my political opponents on the right or those who have lauded me on the left without it being tied to an understanding of who I am, where I came from, and what I've learned that may be a benefit to anybody who wants to compete and thrive in unforgiving environments and if they've been knocked down to get back up.
And just for the record, Susan Rice's mother warned her not to go on the Sunday morning talk shows that led to all this controversy. More about that in the book. Again, the title of the book, the memoir, Tough Love, The Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Susan Rice will speak at 7 next Tuesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza through Rainy Day Books. For more information, rainydaybooks.com. Ambassador Rice, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thanks so much.
You bet. After a break, we'll come back and talk about the new performance going on at the new theater restaurant. It's titled The Last Romance, and it stars a couple folks you're probably familiar with. We're going to meet them in just a moment. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Get my perspective and observations on show topics, current events, and more in my newsletter. It's called Kraske Off Mic. You can subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. It only takes a few seconds. It'll arrive every Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, if you've got a need for speed, you're in luck. NASCAR is in Kansas City this weekend. We'll talk about that. We'll recap tonight's Chiefs game and meet an Olympic runner in town for the KC Marathon. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when something works so well, why not try it again? That's exactly what the new theater restaurant has done with Michael Learned and Charlie Robinson. A couple of years ago, the two starred in Driving Miss Daisy at the new theater. Now they're back in The Last Romance, described as a simple falling in love play, only at an older age. Michael is best known for her role as Olivia Walton in the long-running Waltons TV show. She's a 4-time Best Actress Emmy winner. Charlie was the court clerk, Mac, on the sitcom Night Court. Now they're back as Ralph and Carol in The Last Romance. Michael, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, good to have you, too.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
So they say it's the chemistry between you two, Charlie. Is that what the magic is that you two have been able to produce here? And how did you do it?
I believe so. Well, first of all, I think we have this great friendship that just happened when we first started working together. And I think it's a big part of something like this, the making something really happen, is that you got to have a real strong feeling about someone.
Yeah.
And we have that. And I think that's what happened in the first piece we did, Driving Miss Daisy, and it's happening with the show now that we're doing.
So, Michael, do you have to work at it? I mean, you guys, you know, are going to make this look easy, but I've learned over the years that when stuff looks easy, it usually means there was a lot of effort put in behind it. Is that the case or not? Tell me it just doesn't come real easy to you.
Yeah. Comedy is hard.
Yeah.
Comedy is hard.
Really hard. Yeah. Yeah.
And but working with Charlie is just delightful. It is a love story, isn't it? Craig Benton, who is understudying and who's also an actor and a wonderful one, and he said it's like this is the chapter two of Driving Miss Daisy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Charlie, true. This is a simple, compact, four-person production. Mm-hmm. Lay out the plot for us just in a few sentences here.
Well, there's this... first of all, I have to tell you, the story was written by Joe DiPietro.
Pietro.
Yeah. And it was, my character actually was written for an Italian man. And what happened was they wanted to put something together for myself and Michael. So they thought maybe we could possibly try this. And it's a story about a man who is... hangs around at this dog park, and he sees this lady there, and he decides to come back and try to find her. Mm-hmm. And she shows up, and they meet. It doesn't work well for him in the beginning.
I was going to say, it's tough at first.
Oh, it's pretty tough. Yeah, she's not really that interested in him. But as time goes on with the, you know, it starts to work out. He has a sister who is, he lives with, and that's, well, she moved in with him. And she's against the idea of them coming together.
Yeah.
But you know, as how love works, it happens. And it's just a beautiful love story. That's basically it.
Well, Michael, you're all about productions involving falling in love at older ages these days. You just did...
It's because I'm old.
Well, okay. You just did the short film Second Acts, and now it's The Last Romance at the New Theater. Again, older people falling in love. We don't spend a lot of time in this country, it seems to me, focusing on older people falling in love. Why is that, and what's wrong with that?
I think we're a young country. We're sort of a country that's in its adolescence in a way, compared to Europe.
And we prize youth over folks who are older.
I think so. But
does it bother you?
No, not really, as long as people are kind
and
not rude.
Yeah.
And mostly they are. But it's nice to have a love story for two older
folks. That's what I was going to say. It's nice to see a piece where you see... to an older couple, you know, and the thing that I've noticed, I've talked to some of the younger people that have come to see the show. They just absolutely love it because of the fact that it gives them a chance to see these two people who are older. Who
it gives them some perspective.
Absolutely, yeah.
And older people are real people too.
That's right. That's right. So it's beautiful to see that.
And I think the wonderful thing about the appeal of the Waltons was that it made people feel, I think. And this play does that too. It's poignant. It's funny. People tear up and laugh. And I think it works really well.
Yes, it does. And we have a singer in the piece also.
Oh, he's great.
An opera singer that is just absolutely fantastic.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. Oh, he's... And with him, it really does bring the piece together. Mm-hmm. You know, it really becomes a beautiful love story.
Because I was going to say, you mentioned this was written originally for an Italian.
Yeah,
I'm not seeing a whole lot of Italian in you right now. As I look across the table here, Charlie. I hate to break this.
No, I know, and I actually literally can't speak any Italian. You know.
He thinks in Italian.
Yeah.
Let's go with that. We'll go with that. Well, Michael, you mentioned the role of Olivia Walton on the long-running award-embraced TV series. How did that role save your life? Because the role, you've said it came along at a very precarious time in your personal life. Tell us about that.
Well, I was going through a divorce from my first husband. We'd been married when I was 17, so, and I was drinking too much. And, you know, I had to get up and work a, 12-hour day. It was a short day on television, as I'm sure you know. And so it kind of... It was a job where I really had to get my act together and to be the mother of America.
Yeah.
You had to, You had to live up to that.
Ralph Waite, who played your spouse in that series, he helped you get where you needed to be. Again, tell us that story, because it's a side of him that I think a lot of folks might appreciate.
Well, he used to be a minister, and
which shouldn't be a surprise.
And he also drank a lot. I thought he had a serious problem. And one day he told me, he said, you know what, I'm going to a 12-step program. And I said, that is so great. I totally support you in that. And he grabbed me by the shoulder and said, and I think you should come too.
Come with me, yeah.
And
well, you were taken aback by that, right?
I absolutely
was.
That
he knew your secret maybe? He sensed something was amiss?
How do you know all this? Well, we used to drink together.
Okay.
We'd go out for lunch and have a couple of martinis and a glass of wine or two and reel our way back onto the set. And so that couldn't go on.
Yeah. You tested with Ralph Waite and Richard Thomas, again, the big stars of the Waltons, to get the role. How nervous were you? Because I guess you were coming undone that day, if I remember correctly.
I was. I was alone. I had been married since I was 17, and I was alone. I was staying in a motel for $12 a night. I had no money. I hadn't expected to audition for this.
And they had been auditioning a lot of people, and it just wasn't working, and then you came through the door.
Well, I was too young, and they were looking for somebody with long red hair, and I had short blonde hair, and it was all wrong. But a woman named Ethel Winant, who was the head of casting for CBS, she went to bat for me, and God bless her, because it really did make all the difference in the world in my life.
Yeah. You say you have two families now, your personal family and the Waltons. Is that still the case in your
Absolutely.
Life?
Absolutely.
That's an amazing thing after all these years.
It really is. And they are, the girls are like my daughters, and we're all friends now too. As your kids get older, you become friends, hopefully.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And so I'm very lucky.
Yeah. Mm. How often do you see them?
As often as possible, but we're going to get together in December. We're going to do an autograph signing in Virginia. And so we look forward to those reunions because we have so much fun.
Yeah. Why did that program strike such a chord in this country? Why did it work?
I don't know.
Paper,
that would be an interesting question for me to ask you, because I don't know if you ever saw it, but
sure.
A lot of guys didn't. But I think because it made people feel, and because family. I went to Bangladesh once, and I was doing it for Save the Children. I had no thought that anybody would relate to the show at all in Bangladesh, of all places. And they all loved it because it's about family, and it's universal.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with the two stars of the New Theater's production of The Last Romance, Michael Learned and Charlie Robinson. Mm-hmm. I should point out that The Last Romance runs until November 17th at the New Theater. Tickets, newtheater.com. You know, Charlie, I got to ask, why are you guys still acting? why are you still doing this?
Oh, wow.
I wonder that about a lot of the new theater stars.
Said that, and I was thinking about retiring after this show.
This is it.
No, yeah. I'm just kidding. You know, I find that, you keep growing. Every time you do something, you find something else about yourself. And that's what I found that's so beautiful about doing this kind of work, is that I keep learning things that about myself that I didn't know, and to also to be able to work with beautiful people, it's just so great to be a part of that.
And, is it harder or easier now? How does it roll for you?
It really hasn't changed. Sometimes you get something and it just feels so right by it, and then sometimes you get something and it's a struggle. You know, and it's always been that way through my whole career. And I want to tell one story about when I did this series called Buffalo Bill before Night Court, and of course Night Court ran for 9 years, but before that I did this with Dabney Coleman, and it was on for 2 years, and I'll never forget that I had been working for years as an actor even before that, but I was like most actors, I was working in security. And the interesting thing was is that I the gentleman who was the supervisor there at the security job that I had, I told him, you know, I had this meeting for Buffalo. This is before I got Buffalo Bill. I had the audition. I went in and I had this audition. And they had me to come in like 5 or 6 times. Finally, I ended up getting the job, and I have to go to my superior, and I said, look, I got this job, and I want to be working on the show for I guess 3 months, because they're going to do like 12 episodes. And he said, I got to check to make sure if it's okay. So they went and they found it. He said, okay, we'll let you go. So I went and I did it, and I came right soon as I said, but as soon as I finish, I'm coming right back. So I finished, and I went right back. Then I get this thing. My agent calls and says, you know, they picked the show up for 13 more. I said, you're kidding. So I go back to my superior, and I said, look, I got to tell you. I said, they picked the show up, and it looks like they want me to come back, but I'll come right back after the show. And I was working for Mattel and security. So I go and I do the 13 more, and I finish up, and then I'm back to work. And then they find out that the show was canceled. So I said, oh, fine, well, it's canceled. Then I get this thing, they call and they said, well, they want you for Night Court. And they want you for 22 episodes. So I go back to my superior. I say, I got to tell you something. He says, what? I say, look, it looks like I might be working on this show called, a new show called Night Court, and they want me for 22 episodes, but as soon as I'm done, I'll be back. He said, you won't be back after this. He said, go ahead. Yeah. If you want to come back, fine. So,
is that how easily you got the role on Night Court? They just saw you on the other show and here you...
Actually, you know, they had talked to me possibly I was going to either go to Night Court or Cheers.
You're kidding.
No, yeah, right at that. I was at that point where... And they decided to go with I forgot the gentleman's name, but they went with on Cheers. But I had gotten a message before that I would probably go to either one of those shows. And a gentleman from the press called me and told me. And I went to my agent. I said, you know, it looks like I might be going to the show. And he said, Night Court. He said, oh, don't believe anything the press say. They don't know what they're talking about. And then 2 days later, they hired me.
That's amazing. That's amazing. We're going to have to give it up right there. Michael Learned, Charlie Robinson, they star in The Last Romance. It runs through November 17th at the New Theater. Great food out there. Tickets, newtheater.com. What a pleasure to meet you both. Have a great run out there.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Coming up, some fun stuff to do this weekend with Spencer Hardwick and Brian McTavish. In the studio here, Brian McTavish is back. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him is Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. He joins us here every week to talk about fun stuff to do on the weekend. And this is amazing because Herb Albert's in town. This is amazing. I used to listen to him as a fourth grade trumpet player.
Yeah.
And like, he's here. He's still around. I can't believe it. Loved his stuff when I was a kid.
He is so around. You know, I played trombone. Never worked quite as well the Herb Albert stuff on the T-bone. But
I used to get my Herb Albert songbook and try to sound like him.
Wow.
And it was always such a failure.
Okay, yeah. Herb Alpert is actually here with his singing wife, Lanny Hall.
Lanny Hall.
Herb and Lanny. Herb, of course, as we've been discussing, the jazz pop trumpet legend. He's on tour, 7:30 Friday. Tickets still left at the Arvest Bank Theater at the Midlands.
You listened to him as a kid, right?
Everybody listened to him.
Everybody did. You couldn't go anywhere without listening to him.
He played a lead trumpet that never tried too hard to impress.
Right.
His horn just seemed to gently point the way to modern pleasures. We're listening to A Taste of Honey.
Did you write that yourself? That's just spectacular.
Well, actually, Spencer helped me out, but I wasn't supposed to tell. Anyway, we're listening to This is A Taste of Honey by Herb, right?
Yes.
It was the big hit off his 1965 album, Whipped Cream.
I had it.
You sure did.
I had the cover.
Then if you know Whipped Cream and Other Delights.
That was hard for adolescent boys.
The cover, how can we put this tactfully? It famously displayed a female model covered in whipped cream.
Yes.
Oh, those naughty 60s. Anyway, he will play all of his hits. I could go on, but we can't go on because we must go on. It's 7:30 Friday, Arvis Bank Theater, Herb and wife Lanny Hall.
Okay.
Sin pensarlo dos veces, porque te quiero ahí.
Oh, that's so nice. That is just so nice. We're talking rumba here, Spencer.
We are. Steve, if you were to go around a dozen or so nightclubs in Kansas City, you'll hear a mix of hip-hop, top 40, a little country. You will not hear Herb Alpert, unfortunately. You also won't hear a ton of rumba, but that doesn't mean the Redux Society doesn't have you covered. They're offering beginner classes for rumba. And for the uninitiated, that's a slow, sensual music with a Latin beat that features hip action known as Cuban motion. It's derived as an Afro-Caribbean dance.
Hip action, they call it.
A little bit of hip action.
Is that where we're going to go
with
it?
Was there some hip action with Herb Alpert? Or not quite?
Oh, you don't know the half of the hip action that was going down many. Well, it was true.
Now, we're going to get some video of Spencer Hardwick performing Roomba next week because you're going to take the class, right?
And then we're all going to wake up and realize that was a dream. I actually want to go to the bachata class, is what I'm interested about. Bachata, salsa, Roomba is the more slow
Roomba, okay.
Sunday, 2 p.m.
Okay, Sunday at 2 o'clock. Where's it going to be?
4247 Walnut.
Okay, not too far away. All right.
Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, let's fly away.
Okay, let's fly away and why not with Ella, right?
Hey, if Ella says that little green men are real,
then they're real. They're real.
Ella doesn't kid around. Ella does not. And you know who else is not kidding around? The people behind the Kansas City Alien Ball. It's the extraterrestrial-friendly dance and costume party with prizes. 8 o'clock Friday night at the Ararat Shrine Temple. Get this. The event is produced by the Missouri Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON for short. It's a nonprofit association actually and truly dedicated to the scientific study of UFOs. So what do you do with the alien ball? You dance to tunes spun by BJ the DJ, who may or may not be an alien, and you wear your favorite alien-related costume, you know, something from a movie or a TV show, or make your own. Prizes for individual, group, and best couple costumes. Real quick, I'm thinking for best couples, if you're a twosome that feels alienated from each other, you've got a leg up or an antenna up or something.
Always thinking.
Sorry, kids from other planets. Cosmic Shindig is for 21 and older only.
It's going to be out of this world.
Yeah. So there's music and there's a sense that something's out there and it's right next to you at the Alien Ball happening 8 o'clock Friday at Ararat Shrine Temple.
All right.
Mac and cheese. Can I have some, please? Mac and cheese, macaroni and cheese. Please, baby, please. With a taste so creamy and a texture kinda dreamy. You make me wanna scream me for that secret recipe. All the girls think they're better.
Of course, we're talking here about mac and cheese, and somebody, maybe one of our producers, maybe Spencer Hardwick, went out and found a mac and cheese song.
Twas quite a chore. Steve, we've done.
Did you find that?
I did. It took me about 15 minutes.
I was going to say, there's not a lot of mac and cheese songs out on the radio these days.
I think the payoff was quite worth it.
Yes.
We've done a grilled cheese festival.
Yes.
We've done a donuts festival, and now it's time for a mac and cheese festival. When we look back on this age, I think we're going to think of it as the second enlightenment. When everyone just decided, let's take all of our guilty pleasures from childhood and dump them into different festivals. So the latest iteration of that here is the Mac and Cheese Festival. It's going down at Berkeley Riverfront.
Can mac and cheese be better than what I remembered out of the box as a kid? Is it really like extraordinary the way some people make it?
So the twist on this one is that local chefs will be preparing it. So it's going to be better than that. Have you seen that Panera video floating around Twitter these days where apparently someone shows how they make macaroni and cheese at Panera. They just boil it, put a pack and boil it in water.
Right.
I don't don't think you'll be getting that this Mac and Cheese Festival.
So this is going to be the real stuff made by really great experts in the mac and cheese realm.
I'm rooting for the four cheese specifically.
Okay, this is going to be at 12:30 in the afternoon Saturday to 7:30 that night at Berkeley Riverfront Park, right?
Berkeley Riverfront Park.
Are you a mac and cheese guy?
I want the mac with the most cheese. As a matter of fact, maybe just hold the mac.
Do you eat it with a spoon or fork? That's the key question.
Well, you know what
That's
I do?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
I think I use a fork, but I use the fork like a spoon, if you know what I mean.
Ah, spork. You're a spork guy.
Right. Exactly. Now we're getting in the spirit
now
of
we're
it.
Getting into
More
it.
Cheese all the time.
Okay, Mac and Cheese Fest this weekend.
This is Halloween. This is Halloween. Pumpkin scream in the dead of night. This is Halloween. Everybody make a scene. Trick or treat. Tell the neighbors on the diaphragm. It's our time.
What do we got here, Dr. McTavish?
Dr. McTavish, the evil Dr. McTavish. Do you remember when Halloween was scary?
I do.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody else does. Spencer, was Halloween scary when you were a kid?
Absolutely. It's still scary.
Well, efforts have been made over recent years.
To sanitize it.
Correct.
Yes, I don't like it.
I don't like it. There's nothing scary about sanitization. Anyway, I've gotten that off my hairy chest. Kansas City Halloween Extravaganza. It's a family Halloween celebration from 2 to 5 Sunday at the Hy-Vee Arena, the newly remodeled Hy-Vee Arena. Now, these kids are invited to come as superheroes, princesses, and I guess monsters, right? Because monsters are still cool to be for Halloween. I mean, I used to put in the plastic vampire fangs and smear on the fake blood. What did you guys like to be for Halloween?
Football player.
I was a Cleo the fortune teller. It was a 1-800. Remember that commercial? I was Cleo.
I do not remember that.
Well,
person.
You are scaring me. That is Goose.
So that's coming up this weekend. What else we got?
Okay, Casey Oktoberfest. In the sort of the same spirit, family fest with yard games and pumpkin picking. Not only pumpkin picking today through Sunday at Casey Pumpkin Patch and Gardener, but pumpkin bowling. And if you've never bowled a pumpkin, you've never bowled.
Okay, I hold in my hands the final selection for this weekend's to-do list coming from Spencer Hardwick.
She says she really grew up poor like me. Don't believe in nothing but the Almighty. Just a little jeans and a pure white tee. She never dreamed forever be nobody wifey. Yeah. She want I mean a pretty but your heart is a myth. Play you like a villain cause she caught in a wave. Tonight I am walking away. Line to buy mine and I grind, yeah.
What do we have here, Spencer?
So that was a cut off of the new Lion King movie called Brown Skin Girls by Beyonce. That's because four colored girls will be coming this week, playing from October 18th to November 10th at the Kansas City Rep Theater Copacan Stage.
Wow.
This is the story of seven black women, each identifying solely by color, who are identified by their color, class, gender, sexuality, geography, and it's been described as a highly personal choreo poem, so very powerful. One of the best things about theater is it can really give you different aspects of the human experience.
Wow, that's coming up this weekend. That's Spencer Hardwick, Brian McTavish with great stuff to do this weekend. Gentlemen, always appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Tomorrow on the show, she's not even 30, but she's an accomplished Olympian, actor, and writer. Alexa Pappas is in town to run the Kansas City Marathon. First, she'll join us here in the studio. I hope you do too. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.